All this year, we celebrate America at 250 on July 4th, 1776, by voice vote. The founders agreed to the final wording of the Declaration of Independence. A month later, they began to sign this document in earnest. Now, this was like signing their death warrants. On August 1, 1776, at Independence Hall, the day before the signing, began Samuel Adams, who was the prime mover behind the whole push for American independence in the first place, gave a speech. And in that speech, he declared, "We have this day restored the sovereign to whom alone men ought to be obedient. He reigns in heaven from the rising to the setting sun. May his kingdom come." And so the next day, on August 2, 1776, beginning with John Hancock, the president of that Second Continental Congress that produced the Declaration of Independence, became the first to sign that document, followed by the others, as many as were able to travel back to Philadelphia. Well, in August 2026, the 250th anniversary of the time of the signing, there was a special webinar, and it is available online at 250declaration.com. One of the organizers of that was Dr. Mark Belisles. He and I had the privilege to co-write a book together called Thomas Jefferson and The God Who Gave Us Liberty. Mark Belisles joins us now. I'm Dr. Jerry Newcomb. This is Vocal Point. Mark, it's great to have you back on the program. Thanks for joining us.
Glad to join with you, Jerry. It was certainly a great event there on August 2nd. Enjoyed that.
Sure. Me too. Now, you work together with a gentleman named Dr. Paul Jaley. He's the president of Plymouth Rock Foundation. And the two of you, I guess, came up with this idea. Just go ahead and wax eloquent on it. And again, I want to refer people to 250declaration.com where they can actually watch that whole event, which is about an hour long.
Yeah, it was really something I wanted to do. I'd thought in general about the need to have those who understand our Christian history as a nation, Christian historians, scholars that really know our history, to have a way to make sure and use this anniversary to remind Americans today of why these principles are based in the Bible and why they're important to remember and pass on to other to future generations. And so, you know, July 4th is when everybody does a big bunch of celebrations, but since August 2nd was that actual signing day, that's what we landed on. Felt like Paul Jaley and I thought, let's just do an online event nationwide. We'll ask Christians all across America, let's commit ourselves like our founders did for us. Let's commit ourselves to these same principles that we'll pray for them and use our influence, educate others, for in the same way our founding fathers passed it on to us. So that's what we did. It was a wonderful event. We had about 14 different Christian history scholars participating and that in the actual teaching, little segments, beautiful little brief segments that were just powerful nuggets of Christian history going about describing this declaration. And then of course, thousands, I think, watched online across the country, and people sometimes at their own home signed their own facsimiles of the Declaration as well as they signed online. So it was a wonderful thing. In fact, people today can still go online and sign the online page and add their names to it or print out from that page a facsimile and sign and you know, frame it and use it whatever they want for the future.
And again, that's at 250declaration.com. I thought some of the interesting background information that some of the scholars were talking about was things that you hadn't really thought about. For example, in the medieval period, so even before the Reformation, there were some of the ideas that worked their way into the Declaration of Independence that were very important in terms of, you know, there is a time to obey God, and obeying God in some cases may actually mean civil disobedience. I mean, we find that concept even in the Bible. We find it in the Old Testament. We find it in the New Testament. I mean, a perfect example is Daniel. Daniel was thrown into the lion's den for disobeying the government, but he was disobeying the government just by saying prayers. And so anyway, it's deep in the Judeo-Christian tradition, the ideas that were brought forth so brilliantly in the Declaration of Independence.
Yeah. And it's finally, you know, a lot of people who do not really understand the background would not necessarily have an obvious understanding of what those principles in that whole basically preamble of the Declaration, when Jefferson is the primary author, summarized what he says the American mind, really he was summarizing the Christian mind when it comes to government, when it comes to justice and our responsibility as citizens. And so a lot of times, even though it's not very religious language per se in the Declaration for a lot of these things, it is all very strongly rooted in the Bible. And that's what our scholars pointed out. Plus, of course, God's mentioned four times in the document. So it's really an amazing testimony.
Tell us about the statement from Jefferson that became really the genesis of the title, at least, of the book that you and I did together. He said, "The God who gave us life at the same time gave us liberty, and can the liberties of a nation be secure if we remove the conviction that these liberties are the gift of God?"
Yeah, Jefferson penned that in the document he wrote in 1774, I believe it was, or 75, when he was first in the Congress and involved as a legislator. He began to express these kinds of ideas of connecting our faith, our God, to our freedom, our liberties. And that was like in this summary of our rights, of British rights, of American rights. That was even before independence. But in the same way, Jefferson was known in 1774 for also authoring basically this proclamation for a day of fasting and prayer on the day of the Boston port was shut down, as well as he did other things that really laid the foundation where a lot of people don't understand why was he so much chosen by the Congress saying, "Why don't you draft this?" Well, they knew he expressed kind of how they felt. They expressed their beliefs, their faith, as well as their understanding of the issues going on in the conflict with Britain.
You know, I wonder if some people listening to this might think, are you sure Jefferson said that? I mean, I've seen these terrible statements Jefferson said about, oh, you know, the Gospels contain dunghills, and then, but some of the statements of Jesus are like diamonds that you pick out of the dunghills. But, you know, he's implying bad things about some of the Gospels. And is that the same Jefferson you're talking about who called for fasting and prayer for the founding fathers in Virginia to participate in?
Yeah. It can be confusing, especially because this is how modern biographers present Jefferson. They make the mistake of anachronism. They take maybe quotes he might have said 50 years later in his life about even a whole different topic and read that back earlier into his life and his mindset, you know, the time of the Revolution. But if you really look at the context of the Revolutionary period, that Jefferson that is so famous is the one who, in fact, 6 months after drafting the Declaration of Independence, he drafted the founding document for a church in Charlottesville that he titled the Calvinistical Reformed Church, and it had an evangelical Anglican preacher that Jefferson gave the most money to. This is what he called our church. It was clearly he was identifying with that, and so you have the quotes from late in life that are just overblown. There's probably 300 quotes by Jefferson toward clergymen and people over his lifetime. Only like about less than 10%, probably even more like 5%, were ever written to people that would be considered unorthodox and where he was kind of discussing beliefs and views about things. And that's been overblown. But it's there, but it needs a contextual understanding for people to understand. But it doesn't take away from what Jefferson believed at the time of our founding. That is what made him famous.
You know, it's interesting. Whenever I write about some of these things, and let's say I will quote him from that subscription that he wrote up for that Calvinistical Reformed Church of Charlottesville, which met at the local courthouse of that city. When I do, I look for the Library of Congress version. So in other words, these are things actually found on the Library of Congress website, February 1777, something like Subscription for a Clergyman by Thomas Jefferson. And he says, we being desirous of gospel knowledge and having the Holy Scriptures you know, explained to us that's the reason why we're founding this church. Now, this is Jefferson saying this a year after he wrote the Declaration of Independence. So you're right about the anachronism. Yes, later he – so what caused him to lose, you know, some of his faith that he professed earlier in Jesus?
Well, I mean, I think there are a lot of context for everything, but I think one of the most important things is to recognize that his late in life, when he was retired from the White House, the dominant, first off, there was no church he could be a part of in the Episcopal Church. He had been all his life before that. There was no church even in existence. There was no pastor, Episcopal pastor, no services. But there were the dominant church for most of his retirement years was called the restorationist kind of churches, these Christian only kinds of churches, and they rejected creeds and confessions. Their leaders doubted that the scriptures came down to us pure and unadulterated. These were Christian pastors saying things like this. Jefferson was influenced by that. I think he was, not himself, trained theologian. So he was kind of debating intellectually some of these things that were, he was not really qualified to even understand, but that's what's there. And it was always private to different skeptics or people, or again, even these restoration preachers. He was writing to them these things in debate in private. And his own pastor from early life, Charles Clay, said, just make sure you don't get this out into public because people won't understand you like I do as a member of the church. So those are context for Jefferson, even late in life.
But also, wouldn't you say that there's a Unitarian influence as well in the case of Joseph Priestley, who wrote a book called The Corruption of Christianity? It seems like what Jefferson was saying, you know, where he's questioning whether the scriptures were fully revealed and divine, of divine origin, later in life he's saying that. Wasn't he influenced by Joseph Priestley and other Unitarians?
Definitely. He said he based a lot of his beliefs on Priestley's writings. That's for sure. I think, though, what gave him the courage to be a little bit more bold about his belief was not Priestley, who himself was not as respected as just the local pastors in his area. Or even if you go to up in New England, you know, John Adams was a part of the Unitarian Church. It was already well accepted up in New England, Unitarianism. So it was more of the kind of, I think, a variety of influences that led him to kind of to adopt those views.
It's interesting, though, because then later when the Episcopal Church reopens in Charlottesville, Jefferson joined that, and that would involve the weekly getting up with the congregation and reciting the Apostles' Creed. The Apostles' Creed is basically Trinitarian in its formula. You know, it's essentially, I believe in God the Father, I believe in Jesus the Son of God, and I believe in the Holy Ghost.
Yeah, and there is no evidence whatsoever. He clearly, there's evidence he went to that church, he was tithing, he was supporting it, he was a friend of his pastor until his death, and the pastor buried him. It was clearly, seems to be, he had no qualms with doing that at that point in the last 6 years of his life. And I think that's, even there's no commentary by any other people that he, you know, opted out or exempted himself from that. Unlike sometimes even George Washington, people think he didn't take communion, but Jefferson was never once accused of declining participating in the Trinitarian, you know, activity, liturgy of the church.
So, but in any event, the big picture of things is that when Jefferson was of great cause or great importance to the American cause, especially when he wrote the Declaration of Independence, and then also even as one of the earliest governors, maybe the second governor, I guess, and when he contributed to the idea of religious freedom in his Virginia Statute for Religious Freedom, which he wrote in 1777, Jefferson, by all outward appearances, was definitely a professing Christian. Well, Mark, we're out of time. Thank you so much for being with us. 250declaration.com for more information.